If you have your Bibles, let's take them out. Let's turn together to the book of Nehemiah. You know, we got a new year upon us, and a lot of you... Well, let me just get a show of hands. Let's be a little interactive. How many of you do New Year's resolutions? You sit down, you think them through, you write them out. A whole bunch of you. All right, great. Well, it's good. I mean, a new year is a perfect time to do some evaluation, isn't it? You're marking. There's a freshness about it. You're ready to get going on a number of things, and you want to start making your plans and be more efficient with your life and go out there and somehow make a difference. You know, not let life just be these series of events that happen one after the other, and then before long you notice all this time has gone by and you never really did anything. So we like to stop and think about that. And we live in a day and age, though, in which there's a fad, and maybe it's not just unique to us, but the fad is that you got to do something to be noticed. See, it's not enough just to do something. It's something and get noticed in the process. And so as a result, there's a call that goes out to us, you know, and it's show your success. Show us what you did and how that success is manifest. So there's a lot of pressure, especially in Loudoun County. You got to have that great, big, nice house. You know, got to be working in the big, fast-paced city these days. You got to have the big car. And above all else, you better have that adrenaline-racing occupation and that adrenaline racing ministry as you serve God and get out there in the world and make a difference for Him. And there's a call. It's get out there, folks, and be radical. You know, be on the outer edge, and even in the Christian life, but change the world, make a difference. And your biggest enemy, if that's the mindset, your biggest enemy is ordinariness. Worst thing that can happen to you is to be normal. And like everybody else. In some ways, it's sort of like Emmett in the Lego movie. You saw the Lego movie, right? Yeah, say yes. Yes, okay, good. If you haven't, I'm questioning your salvation at this point. You got to get out there and see that. But Emmett is the main character in that story. And he's led to believe something. You, Emmett, you're the chosen one. You're the one that everyone's prophesied for and ready for. You're going to be the one that makes a big difference. And as the movie unfolds, he keeps looking, how does this happen? I don't have a clue as to what I'm doing. And before long, you get set up for failure. We start the year out thinking, this is all these big things I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to make a difference for God. And then come February, March, July, next thing you know, we're looking, it's like, didn't really pull anything big off, anything major. But we continue to charge, don't we? We're asking the question, how will I be the hero? How will I stand out at your job? How are you going to take your job to the whole next level? And, you know, just have them recognize, well, you're the best thing that happened to us in the hiring process. We're so fortunate to get you. Or maybe for some of you, it's, you know, that goal, that aspiration. You want to be that mother that everyone else looks at and says, be like her. She's the one. She's got it figured out. The call, the pressure is to raise that child who's going to be the next superstar. Maybe it's on the athletic field or maybe it's in the academic realm, but you know, there's a lot of pressure there. They've got to make a difference. So they got to stand out and break out. What are you going to do about that? Or maybe in some cases, it comes down to your ministry. How are you going to take your church to the whole next level? How are you going to take your ministry and start working towards this mega level? And the reality for most of us is that's not the case. It won't be the case. And frankly, I don't even think that's necessarily what God is even calling us to. Can you say that? For most of us, God's plan is a whole lot less complex than we make it out to be. And maybe in many cases, I wonder too, if it isn't maybe a little less stressful than we make it to be. I think it's better. And can even possibly be more enjoyable. Because God calls us to something. He calls us to a simple faith. And much of our life then becomes one of simple faithfulness. One step at a time. For the next few weeks, what we're going to do is we're going to look at the book of Nehemiah. We're going to look at this gentleman's life. And study it and see how this simple faith and simple faithfulness played out in his life and what God did in and through him. Now, some of you, by nature of the fact that I just said we're going to study a guy, Nehemiah, you may say, well, Jack, right now you're almost in opposition to what you've just been promoting because you're exalting an individual. You're showing how this guy broke out, stood out from everybody else. But actually, what I think we're going to discover is Nehemiah doesn't really break out all that much. He's a pretty simple, he's a pretty ordinary guy. Somebody who has an ordinary life, a simple faith, and somebody who has what I'll call a God-blessed burden. Now, let me define my terms here, because some of you already are getting turned off by what I'm talking about at this point. What do I mean when I say ordinary? When I say ordinary, I do not mean mediocre. Mediocre, that definitely has a negative connotation, doesn't it? It means something less than satisfactory, something poor or inferior. When I say ordinary, I mean he's not this rock star. He doesn't break out as a superstar from everybody else. He's right there with everyone else. And when I say somebody with a simple faith, I'm not talking about somebody who's ignorant. Ignorant means lack of knowledge. Instead, what do we find in here? He's somebody that has a very clear focus and understanding on the person and the character and the power of God. And finally, what I mean by a God-blessed burden is I don't mean that he has this thing that just weighs all the time and makes life miserable and, you know, almost like the thorn in the flesh mentality. I'm not talking about that at all either. Instead, it's something that God has impressed upon him, something that God has told him struck a chord within his heart to say, this is important. This is what I want you to focus on, and he did. So what we're going to do for the next several weeks, we are not going to be looking at a superhero called Nehemiah. We are going to be looking at an amazing super God who could take an ordinary person and do extraordinary things. So to look at Nehemiah, the first thing we have to do, we got to get a little context. You got to step into the story because that's what we do. When you get into verse 1, you're right in a story. So let's get some of the background on this, what's going on here. 1,000 years before this story begins, Israel was in slavery to Egypt. And God said, I'm going to deliver you out of the slavery. And he did it miraculously, extracted an entire nation of about 2 million people out of slavery from another nation and gave them a land. He promised them land, seed, and a blessing. And he moved them out to that land. They began to occupy it. But there was a major problem that Israel had. It's called idolatry. And over again, they had a propensity to bend towards worshiping other things besides God. I mean, they barely made it out of Egypt before they had the whole incident with the golden calf that they were worshiping. And that continued for years and years and years. They kept leaning towards and moving towards idol worship. And so God said, I'm going to break you. I'm going to break you of this. What he did is in 722 BC, he brought this nation in called Assyria. They came in and they invaded the northern 10 tribes of Israel and took them all captive. Very few were left behind. Many were killed and the rest were exiled, taken to various other countries and places. And the southern kingdom kind of hung in there for a little bit, but about 150 years later or so in 586 BC, they too fell, this time to Babylon. And it's the same thing happened. They were captured, many were killed, and most were exported to other places. And God used it as a means to break them of idolatry so that they would be forced to turn back and to recognize him as their one and only God. But as part of all that, a lot of things happened. Their walls were destroyed, the walls that surrounded the city. And the temple itself was sacked and burned and destroyed and leveled and all the articles taken out. But then after a certain time had gone by, God said, okay, now I'm going to do another miracle. I'm going to take you out of exile. I'm going to bring you back and put you back into your country. And so he moved a king, the king of the Medo-Persians, his name is Cyrus, to issue a decree that says the Jews can go back and enter into their land again. And in doing so, reestablish their temple worship, reestablish their place within their land. And so they began to do that. Many took on that venture. That was a dangerous trek, by the way. 700-mile journey for many of them in getting there. So not everybody went, but some did. And a fellow named Zerubbabel led a pack to go out there, and they began to rebuild the temple itself so that they could do their worship there in the land, but the building was halted. And several years later, Ezra the priest took another group and began to set up people there and begin to lean towards worship, but they still weren't able to get everything reestablished. The walls were still down. The temple was still not built. And that brings us to where we are in the story. That catches us up. So Nehemiah chapter 1 begins with the who, where, and the when that we need. Verse 1, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital. And we'll stop right there. There's our who, Nehemiah. He's a Jew, and he's one of these people that's born into exile. And he's living in Susa, which is the winter capital for the king of Babylon. And later in the chapter, we'll find his job. He's called the cupbearer to the king. This was a day and age where a lot of times, if you wanted to change the government, rather than have an election, you just whacked the leader. You killed him, assassinated him. And one of the ways that they would do that is they would poison their food. So Nehemiah gets that great job of having to sample the drink that the king would have before the king does. And that way you die first. And now they know, that's bad, don't drink it. Okay, I got it. He's over the wine, he's over other things too. It's kind of an administrative job, but it's a federal job. He'd fit in real good in Northern Loudoun, wouldn't he? Where so many of you work in these federal jobs. He just didn't have a commute. That's how he's different from many of you. And there's nothing really very spectacular about him. I want you to notice that as time goes on. He's a pretty ordinary fellow. Employee number 6343-6424 of the Babylonian government. Got his little badge that he wears in the kingdom. And he's living far from his homeland. He didn't get to be part of the big, exciting expedition that took that 700-mile journey. We don't know why. Whether he chose not to or whether he just wasn't allowed to. But for some reason, he didn't. He stayed behind doing his daily job faithfully, day after day. And then one day he got some news. It's in verse 2. Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came. So these were brothers of his that had gone out to Judah, and now they've come back into the Susa. And I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity and about Jerusalem. Now note that. His question reveals something about him. It tells us what's important to him. He wants to know, how are these Jews doing who made that dangerous trek, who went there for the purposes of reestablishing our people in this land? How's it going over there? What are they doing? And you kind of get a glimpse into his heart, don't you? He's not one of the main religious guys. He's not a scribe or, you know, what would later be a Pharisee or one of the religious leaders or readers of the law. He simply knows some basic doctrines, as far as we can tell, and he believes them. God made a covenant with the Jews, and part of that covenant was to put them back into that land, and the Jews would possess it. And just as God delivered Israel from Egypt, so he was delivering them from Babylonia and Assyria and Medo-Persia. And he heard the news of the long trek that these people had, and he's wondering, how are they doing? How did it go? And what's important to him is the welfare of God's people, and the news is not good. Verse 3. They said to me, well, the remnant there in the province who survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. Now, why is that bad? Well, it comes down to this. A reproach against the Jewish people is a reflection of what people will think of their God. Their God must be mighty. He got them out, but he can't sustain them in the land. And it's a stain on the glory of God himself for anybody looking on. People would see this and would think, I don't want to be a Jew. That God isn't very strong. Look at how they live in this land. Yeah, they escaped captivity, but to what? I don't think I want to be a part of that. I would liken it to this. If you were a visitor, maybe, and you came into church this morning, and as soon as you walked in the doors, you were hit with the stench of sewage, and you dismissed that. You came on into the building. You saw trash all over the floor. Chairs are in disarray. Paint's chipped on the walls and everything else. That's going to communicate some things to you. You're not sure what exactly. Either these people don't care, nobody here gives, they can't maintain stuff here, or something in between. But something is going to be communicated to you that's bad. Well, that's what the news has done for Nehemiah. He knows this is a bad reflection on God and his character and his person and his glory. And it breaks his heart. Burns deep right here. Verse 4. And when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. There's an old saying goes like this: that which makes you laugh or cry is what shows your character. And you see what shows his character here. It's the glory of God. It's a burden that God has given him. I don't want to see God's glory like this. I don't want people to get the wrong idea of who he is. And the fact drove him to, as the verse continues to say, fast and pray before the God of heaven. And that's where the burden must begin. It doesn't begin with pen and paper. It doesn't begin with a clear plan and with a mission. It begins with going before the Lord to make sure that this is a burden that I feel is from you, and to know what you want. Not my plans, not my ideas. What do you want? Now, this is the part in the story where I want to be candid with you, because I struggle here with a little bit of what it is that I'm communicating to you, and I want to be careful about it. Because on the one hand, we can look at Nehemiah, and we will see God do extraordinary things. God will do these things. And he'll use Nehemiah to accomplish them. What I'm encouraged about is to see how regular he is. That's what gives me hope. Not that he's a superstar, but he's a regular Joe. My concern, though, is after studying a book like this and investigating and looking at this, people are going to walk away asking this question: oh, that's great. What will I do great for God? How am I going to be doing great things for him? And I'll tell you the reason why I'm uncomfortable with that, because I don't think that's the right question. I don't think that's the thing that we should be investigating. Instead, our concern ought to be just like Nehemiah's. It ought to be centered upon the glory of God, not what we're going to do. And there's a big difference. It's got to start with his glory, because too often, this is what we mean. What will I do for my glory as I seek to do things for the glory of God? And we've put the cart before the horse when we've done that. We've turned things around. In fact, sometimes we can pervert our efforts towards the ministry as a means of self-glory, taking what rightfully ought to be exalting of God and using it, leveraging it for our own purposes. I mean, come on, we're Americans, right? This is part of what our warp and woof is, that we pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, and if we don't see something that's good, we're going to make it better, and we're going to get in there, we're going to fix it, and we're going to leave something that is much bigger and better and faster than when we found it. And a big part of that, and a big part of the motive for doing that, is actually to validate our existence. Not necessarily to exalt God. So it's not enough that we're going to be a part of this thing. I got to be the leader of this thing, because I got to break out. I got to stand out. I got to be the reformer in this whole situation. I want to be on the winning team when it's all said and done. And yet it's interesting, because whenever I take this and I begin to read it and I begin flipping through the pages, it's amazing to me how often I find that God is glorified with people who are actually very simple. People who are very ordinary. People that are often faceless, and sometimes they're even nameless to us. And we find God specializes in using, are you ready for this? The weak and the simple and the ordinary. Often it is not the spectacular that God uses. Sometimes he operates despite that. And frankly, we're not comfortable with that. There's something about it that rubs us wrong. Too easily we use the ministry to establish our identity rather than finding our identity in the person of Christ. It's going to be in what we do for Christ and how we're used by Him. So we're not content to be simple. And we're not content to be steady. And we're not content to be plain. Before long, what happens is when we bought into this mentality, here's how we view people. People are actually props that we use to build our kingdom with. The poor become our cause. Children, they're those people that get in our way, that slow us down from doing what it is we really got to be doing. And our jobs, that's that thing I just got to put up with. You know, you don't like it, but you got to do it. And we just endure it. Now some in this room will do things. And the end result is, by at least the way we measure them, we might all stand up and say, yeah, that's great. That's recognizable. That's something worth, you know, looking at and remembering. But I think God's standard of measurement is very different than what we often will use. And Nehemiah is going to show us this. God uses the simple. He does. The ever steady faithful. Can I give you a few other examples besides Nehemiah? Take Mary, the mother of Jesus. What made her great? Here's a young teenage woman, uneducated, very poor. What did she have that made her great? Nothing. She was just chosen by God. She was a very simple person. She was a faithful, steady person. But that's it. Or how about that savvy businessman, the tax collector Matthew, you know, one of the disciples? Oh, well, there's the guy. He had to have made a difference, right? I mean, he knew how to make money. He knew how to get things done. And yet, what do we most often remember about him? Not that much. He was just a simple man. He gave things up to just to be simple and follow his Lord. Or maybe we can just examine some of the other disciples. If I mention Peter, if I mention John, Matthew, maybe some of you might remember Thomas or Andrew. You'll remember those names, but I'll bet 90% of us can't name all 12 of the disciples. They're not that significant to us. We don't remember their names. They're just a little too ordinary. And yet that's exactly the people that Jesus Christ invested in and handed his ministry off to. If you take Nehemiah 1, you just flip a few pages over to chapter 7. That's a chapter that we normally skip over. We dismiss it, and I'll tell you why. When you look at it, you'll see why. It's nothing but names. Very hard to pronounce names at that. And what we find in that chapter is God noticed the people, and he knows their name. And he locked it in for eternity. Faceless to us, but they were the steady. They were the few. They were the ones that God chose to use. And use them he did. We long for the heroes. We long for the heroine. God remembers the small and the steady and the simple. I'll tell you somebody else that you can look at in this with this mindset too, and that's Jesus Christ. Very interesting to me how Jesus begins his ministry ministering to thousands. Thousands will come and listen to him, and yet by the time he goes to the cross, it's diminished to maybe at the most about 100, 120. That's it. We fire pastors that go from 5,000 to 120. Something's wrong. Jesus' ministry is very simple, isn't it? Not very extravagant. And yet God used it in a mighty way. And that's why I get a little uncomfortable when we start making the call to tell everybody, be radical, you know, stretch out there for Christ. I get the intent. I get what people are saying. I don't want to try to nitpick everything. But I think we do have to be careful that our lives don't then become about our next project, our next mission, and our next task. And that we are discontent with being a simple follower of Jesus Christ. And that's why I'm cautious when we go through this book and as we teach it and looking at Nehemiah. Part of my goal and what I'm praying for is that we don't see ourselves as necessarily breakout people, but rather we see how God fits us into His grand meta-narrative and what that's going to look like. And that we would be content if it's a simple plan. That we would be very content if it's an ordinary plan. And if we do great things, it's not because we are seeking great things, especially for ourselves. There's a blogger, her name is Trish Warren, and she wrote of being raised in the wealthy evangelical church. She said, every week, church was about the same thing, saving souls and being a generally respectable Republican Texan. And she spoke of having graduated from high school and moving on, and she went out and served in the mission field. And she came back from the mission field, and she met the new associate pastor and began to talk with him. She talks about that conversation here. And she says that he said this when he saw her. He said, oh, you. Oh, I've heard about you. You're the radical who wants to give your life away to Jesus. She writes, well, it was meant to be a compliment, and I took it as one. But it also felt like a lot of pressure because in a new way, I was torturously uncertain about what being a radical and living for Jesus was supposed to mean for me. Here I was back in America needing a job and health insurance, toying with dating this law student intellectual who wasn't all that radical and unsure about how to be faithful to Jesus in an ordinary life. I'm not sure I even knew if that was possible. And she goes on to write, now I'm a 30-something with two kids living a more or less ordinary life. And what I'm slowly realizing is that for me, being in the house all day with a baby and a two-year-old is a lot more scary and a lot harder than being in a war-torn African village. What I need courage for is the ordinary. The daily everydayness of life. Caring for a homeless kid is a lot more thrilling to me than listening well to the people in my own home. Giving away clothes and seeking out edgy Christian communities requires less of me than being kind to my husband on an average Wednesday morning or calling my mother back when I don't feel like it. See, too often, I think we dismiss that kind of life. And as we look at Nehemiah, what I hope you find is not necessarily a call to be radical, out on the edge, but simple. Not necessarily extraordinary, but faithful. With the God-blessed burden that He gives us. And regarding those burdens that He gives us, be careful with that too. I am convinced if we've got 500 people here between these two services, I doubt we have 500 different burdens. We probably have a lot of overlap because our God is a unifying God. He will call us to a unity. Now, I'll bet most of our burdens are very close and they're very similar, and God's going to call us to use them in and through our community together. So as we begin the new year, I think it is good to ask you, though, has God given you a particular burden? Has He? Is there something that you just, there's that sense of wanting to see His glory in that sphere of life, in that area, particularly that you touch? Some of the ways our church has received God's blessed burden, we put up in different things that we do. I'll tell you one of them that I know is common amongst many of us, and that is the burden of the family. And wanting to raise children, to raise those young ones, to be disciples of Jesus Christ, that's a good burden. For some of you, it isn't just children, it's grandchildren and investing in them. That's a good burden that God gives you. This past week, I had a chance. I was sitting in a Starbucks, changed the scenery a little bit. Sitting in a Starbucks, and as I'm working on this, I just happened to look up while I'm meeting my little Danish working on the computer. And over here in the store, there's this woman. She's probably around 30, give or take 2 or 3 years. Got two children with her. She's got a daughter who appears to be about one, sitting in a high chair. She's just giving her Cheerios on the table. And the little girl's just calmly eating them just like this, being real good. And then across the table from her, she's got this 3-year-old boy. And he's like a carp on the end of a line. You know, he's just going like this all over the place. And she's just sitting there and she's eating her food and she's taking care of them and she's not in any panic. She's just dealing with them. It floored me. I never once saw her pull out the phone. Couldn't believe that. She's just constantly, patiently, lovingly ministering to these two little ones right here while the world of Starbucks is revolving around her and she's completely unnoticed. I noticed. She has no idea I noticed. She has no idea she's being used as a sermon illustration this morning. You could tell, though, that's a burden. It blessed me. It blessed me to watch her in simplicity execute that burden through her kids. Another burden that we have, it's one God gives us. That's to be salt and light to Loudoun, to Northern Virginia. And God has called us to be out there and to mix it up, to be with other people. And there is an ebb and flow as to what level we can do that, isn't there? When we're single like Trish Warren, there's a little bit more latitude to be able to be engaged in that kind of a ministry as opposed to this woman that I saw in the Starbucks the other day. There's an ebb and flow that goes with it. But we have the burden to want to be able to minister and to be that salt and light. For some of you, that burden, it looks more like this. You've got, it's children. You want to be involved in the Sunday school that goes downstairs. Others of you, you're determined to be involved in Awana because you see this is a key time to be engaged in people's lives when they're at that young, formative age. And that's what God's burdened you to be able to do and to want to do. And there's others of you, that burden is regarding men's needs and women's ministry needs. And you want to be there for them and helping them and encouraging them, fostering their faith and building them up. Some of you, it's singles. That's why you're part of the refuge ministry. You're wanting to help them out, to be that blessing unto them. And others of you, you're working with youth because you see the value and the need. You have that burden on your heart to minister to those adolescents in that very turbulent time that they go through and to usher them through that as best you can. And others of you, the burden is orphans. That's why you're engaged with Reflections. You want to see the ones that need adopted get adopted, and the ones that are trying to try to help them and to foster them and being able to do that. And then there's others of you, for you, your burden is reaching the world for Christ. And maybe through your own efforts, or maybe it's through financial efforts, or maybe it's through coming alongside with the missionaries that we have. You're going to be a part of the World Missions Team. Try to support those missionaries as they serve out on the field and engage with others. Or maybe in some of your cases, you're going to go out and do some short-term mission trips. That's the burden that God has given you. But as you consider this God-blessed burden that you have, do something. Don't dismiss the spouse and the children in your home. Don't dismiss that job that you commute to or that you work in your basement. God has you there. And he'll use you there. We'll see that with Nehemiah. Most of ministry happens just like Deuteronomy 6 describes. It's as you're going. You know, we like to try to take our lives and mark them in these epical moments. You know, I've got these three or four epical moments in my life, these grand things that happen, when the reality is most of our life in ministry will happen as a series of 10,000 steps along the way, 10,000 small steps. And our lives can't be measured by counting the great epical moments. We have to see it as how God works in those ordinary, everyday steps that we all make. It's simple. Or it's simpler. Incidentally, this is a big part of the reason why we as a church, a couple of years back, wanted to simplify things. We still have various ministries, but we said, how can we disciple people? And that's why we kind of constructed this idea of the life groups. It's being able to bring people in this smaller group to where they can disciple and encourage and build one another up and not make it an extra burden necessarily, but to find that community and that oneness and instruction in there. And it's why we didn't break them up according to ages. Because we wanted Youth, we wanted your zeal, those of you that are young. And those of you that are old, we wanted your wisdom. Bring it in. I'll let you figure out where you are on this scale. I'm not calling you old, all right? Calling you wise. But you know, we need all of this. We need this together to facilitate the simplicity of the ministry and of life and of living for the glory of God. Now, as I'm saying this, I know there's a few of you. It doesn't sit well right here. Your comment is, Jack, that frankly is just not that inspiring. In fact, what you're talking about is awfully small. It sounds small. It is small in many ways. But I think one of the things we'll learn as we look at Nehemiah and his life is we'll learn this truth, this saying, everyone wants a revolution, yet nobody wants to do the dishes. And our lives are filled with doing the dishes and changing the diapers and making the commute to work and studying for classes and working on that job many times unnoticed and doing that ministry many times in complete and total anonymity. That's what life is really like. So as we start 2015, God may use 2015 to do something pretty radical by our standards in and through you. And that's great. That's great. You might be more like the Apostle Peter, where we remember your name and we remember the things that you did. But the reality is most of us are going to be more like Bartholomew. Some of you are going, who's Bartholomew? He's one of the 12 disciples. One of the ones that we tend to not recall and don't remember. And yet God used. 2015, it needs to be the year that we're living for the glory of God and we check our need for recognition at the door. If he's going to have us recognized, so be it. If not, so be it. And we'll be content with that fact. We get to be lowly servants of Jesus Christ. And friends, that's enough. If that's all we get, that's enough. That same blogger, Trish Warren, gives this summary. I'm going to let this close us. She says, I've come to the point where I'm not sure anymore just what God counts as radical. And I suspect that for me, getting up and doing the dishes when I'm short on sleep and patience is far more costly and necessitates more of a revolution in my heart than some of the more outwardly risky ways that I've lived in the past. And so this is what I need now. The courage to face an ordinary day. An afternoon with a colicky baby where I'm probably going to snap at my 2-year-old and get annoyed with my noisy neighbor. To do that without despair. To have the bravery it takes to believe that a small life is still a meaningful life. And the grace to know that even when I've done nothing that is powerful or bold or even interesting, that the Lord notices me and is fond of me. And that is enough. This can be the year that God is glorified through your marriage, through how you treat your spouse, even when they don't treat you right, but how you respond and love selflessly to them. It can be the year that God is glorified in the simplicity of just raising your children as you are just faithful one day at a time. Doing those daily tasks. This can be the year that God is glorified in the simplicity of maybe meeting your neighbors through a variety of creative and very easy means. Maybe this is the year God can be glorified in the simplicity of your job as you pursue just doing it to the best of your ability for the glory of God. But ultimately, this is what it needs to be. It needs to be the year when God is exalted by the everydayness of our lives. Nehemiah is going to be Exhibit A. God specializes in using very ordinary people who have a simple faith, who simply embrace the God-blessed burden that he's placed upon them. Would you bow with me?